Today's program is brought to you by Wisconsin Cheese. Did you know that Wisconsin wins more national and international cheese awards than any other state or country? To learn more, visit wisconsincheese.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
Welcome to Feast Your Ears. I'm Harry Rosenblum. Join me every Wednesday as I talk with people about what they do and how it influences their personal food stories. This is a show about people, life, and food. I have to take a moment today to do a little shameless self-promotion. As some of you who listen to the show regularly may know, I wrote a book called Vinegar Revival, came out last fall, and I've gotten a lot of good press recently, and so I just wanted to give a thank you and a shout out. The New York Post had me in a photo last week for an article about vinegar. I was in the New York Times today in a really great article that talks about how to make vinegar. Another host here on the network, Michael Harlan Turkell, who also wrote a book about vinegar called Acid Trip, is also featured in that article. So Heritage Radio is getting kind of a big. We have a lot of people in the Times today, I guess. And I was on Action Bronson's television show, the Action Bronson Untitled show last night. You can find that on Viceland. Layla Ali, Muhammad Ali's daughter, who's a boxer, also just wrote a great book. She was on there too. Some other fun stuff, so check that out. Today is episode 96 of Feast Your Ears, and I'm really pleased to have Dan Delaney here from Delaney Chicken and the much-loved but sadly now closed Delaney Barbecue, which used to be here in Williamsburg. Thanks, Dan, for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
So I'm going to cut right to the chase. You're from New Jersey. Why barbecue?
Well, you know, I think that when you think about barbecue as Southern food, then that's a real question. But if you think about it as, if you think about it as American food ways, like it's just like one of many longstanding traditions, then there's more of a corollary. And that's how I think about it. Like when I was a kid, I lived in North Jersey and we would take this little boat that we lived on a river in the Hackensack River. We'd take the little boat down the river and we'd tie up behind this like legendary burger place called the White Manna.
Oh, I know the White Manna. Yeah. There's two of them,
there's,
right?
There were originally four. There's two okay. Now. Yeah. Spelled differently too. But we would go to the one in Hackensack and that was like, I think my earliest introduction to just sort of this like, just like a classic institutional restaurant.
Sure.
Right?
Sure.
These sort of like indelible family-owned businesses that stand the test of time and kind of are really well-known for one thing. And I've been attracted to that for a long time. So when I was down spending time in Texas and all through the South, really, I was always gravitating towards the same thing. But the regional version of that. And sure. So when in Texas, that was very much barbecue.
Yeah. I mean, I think you make a great point. I mean, I love White Manna and I love places like you're describing, mm-hmm. right? And in the South, I mean, I have not been to very many of those in Texas, but I was just recently in Atlanta. I went to Daddy D's Barbecue in Atlanta. Mm-hmm. I went to Fat Matt's Barbecue in Atlanta, and they very much are that. They don't do avocado toast in the morning. Mm-hmm. They don't do espresso drinks. They do brisket. They do pulled chicken. They do pulled pork. Mm-hmm. You can get the same essentially sides at each of them.
Yep.
And that's what they do. Mm-hmm. And there's no, you know, there's no changing around of that menu.
Yeah. I really like that. I mean, if I make a pie chart of like the type of restaurants that I go to, these like sort of institutional family owned specialty restaurants makes up at least 50% of where I go.
Yeah.
If
well,
not
and
more.
And I think that, you know, I mean, the other side, so I find that as like an interesting reaction as someone who, like being from North Jersey, I mean, I grew up in the tri-state area where I feel like the Greek diner is like the ubiquitous dining experience yeah. where you have a menu that's like 73 pages long
sure.
and they can make 900 different things because that's meant to serve everybody. Yeah. Right? It's meant so you can go there with 12 people and one person wants breakfast and one person wants meatloaf and mashed potatoes and one person wants a salad and someone else wants disco fries, right? Like, you can get all of that in that location. And so I feel like that's an interesting, you know, maybe that's a reaction against that for you being from Jersey.
No, I mean, I cherish the diner. I love the diner so much.
I'm not trying to talk bad about the diner.
No, I mean, it tucks neatly into the same kind of thing. I mean, ultimately, what we're saying is it's like, it's celebrating these like family-owned businesses that have been fortunate enough to be around for a while.
Yeah.
And that's, I mean, whether it's a diner or it's a, you know, little family-owned bakery or whatever, that is a through line in, I think, what I really enjoy with food. And I mean, and also there's like a little eccentricity, like people that own a hot dog place in the middle of, you know, Kennebunk, and then just like do this one hot, I mean, there's something insane about this. Like they obsessed about their chili or their whatever. And it's always fun to be around people that are obsessive about something.
Sure. I mean, you mentioned Maine, you know, there used to be, it's now gone, a wonderful place in Freeport, Maine called Cindy's that was run by a man named Bob Pottle and his wife Frida, who became family friends of mine because we would go there. Mm-hmm. And we stopped there two or three times a year going to and from Maine. And, you know, fried clams.
Yeah.
Like that exactly. Was Bob's thing. Fried clams and chowder were like the two specialties that he made. And it was the kind of place where, and I assume the same thing would be true at White Manor or at the, you know, the places you're talking about, where, you know, if something's a little off, they're not going to serve it. Mm-hmm. Right. Whereas mm-hmm. we think of a place like at the diner, if the fries are a little overcooked, right. They're just going to put them on the plate. Yeah, like they don't really care. Yeah. So I think that there's also that, right. You're talking about, there's that care mm-hmm. about this one singular product. So barbecue, you went to Texas. You became obsessed with brisket, right? Am I recounting the story relatively correctly?
Yeah, I mean, I became really fascinated by the culture of barbecue, like these beautiful restaurants that have been open for decades that have these like patina on the walls, and then they haven't changed anything in years. And I like barbecue, actually. It's not my favorite food to eat at all, but I mostly enjoy all of the like cultural ephemera around barbecue.
Sure.
The like grizzly old guy that's like feeding the fire. The really like sort of stubborn and ingrained technique for how they're making what they make. Mm-hmm. And how everybody thinks that their way is the best way. I mean, there's something really beautiful about that.
And they're all kind of great.
Right? Yeah. I mean, like, and they are. Yeah. and when it was time to, when I decided that I wanted to do that, originally it was because when I was down in Texas, I had tried the barbecue at Louis Miller Barbecue. And actually, I tried it when they were in Louisiana. Jane and Michael Stern brought me into one of their festivals, and I got introduced to them through that. And I remember trying that piece of, and it was just like, God, like I never had that growing up. I never put that kind of like amazingly rendered beef in my mouth before. That was like wild. And I remember then coming back up to New York and just like wanting to figure out how to do that. And that set me on a journey of buying ultimately like pretty crappy smokers from the Home Depot and like, you know, one after another, slightly edging toward a larger and larger smoker, and then eventually getting my hands on one in Austin and bringing it up here. And there was no, like, when I finally was in Texas and got my hands on a smoker and brought it up, at that point there was still no idea that I was going to open a restaurant. It was just this idea of that I wanted to learn how to make this,
and you ought to be making it.
Then you did
what I think is really interesting. I mean, I think people get obsessed with these things and they're like, all right, I'm gonna open a restaurant. I mean, barbecue in and of itself, and this could be a whole separate conversation about how difficult traditional barbecue is to do in New York City, mm-hmm. given the Department of Health rules around, sure, cooking inside, outside, and et cetera. But I think the way that you formed that business or started it was really interesting and very smart to really look at, is there a market for this? I mean, you started out essentially throwing barbecue parties.
Yeah.
And you pre-sold tickets so people could come to a place. I remember going to one in Greenpoint. Uh-huh. And, you know, it was just in like an empty lot next to a building. And everybody had to buy a ticket ahead of time, and they'd show up, and you had music and beer, and you handed your ticket, and you got some barbecue, and you like hung out, and you know, and that I feel like was a really smart way to test your market, because if that had failed, right? If only 10 people had showed up every time, I doubt you would have opened a restaurant.
Yeah, I mean, I think that that was a combination of some marketing ability, like some ability to generate interest. And you're right, it was, I mean, and I think that part of it is that we are now, and increasingly every day, in a space where, because of the democratization of food media, because it's because everybody has an Instagram and in a sense now, you know, platforms like Eater are competing with Instagram, you know, authors,
yeah,
or photographers or whatever. There's a much more rapid pace to food media. I think that even institutional platforms like the New York Times are informed by it. I mean, if you look historically at like how, I mean, we're in Roberta's right now. It was years before they got a review in the Times.
Yeah, it's true.
Today, that cycle is very small. I mean, people there's reviews coming out of restaurants after they're open for a few months.
People in the dining room right now who are probably reviewing it essentially, as you point
out,
by writing stuff in Instagram. So if we looked at the geotag for Roberta's, there's probably 100 photos from the last week that have a couple paragraphs written about their experience.
Right. And so, I mean, I think that people become very critical very quickly of restaurants now. So when I started Brisket Lab, the part of the thinking was like, how do I operate in a space that's pretty competitive and give myself the permission to make mistakes?
Yeah.
The permission to figure it out.
Yeah.
And ultimately, by formulating this event series or party series, whatever you want to call it, and doing it under the sort of label of a laboratory environment, it gave us the permission to make mistakes and to sort of not be criticized for it.
Yeah.
But that was, I think, pretty strategic. It was saying like, okay, we also had no permits. It was completely illegal. We were just, you know, this was a rogue venture. And so, a lot of it was just it was just trying to find a way to move forward without the infrastructure that we really needed.
Yeah. But I think you also hit on something. I mean, I think you really tapped a vein of people who wanted barbecue that was cooked that way in New York. And I have to imagine, I mean, I went to, I think, two of those events, and I have to imagine there were a lot of repeat customers who then probably became regulars once you opened a brick and mortar.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. That was actually, I mean, yes. And it was also interesting to see the relationship that, you know, those guests had with the business as we then transitioned into a brick and mortar store, because they felt a real sense of ownership. You know, they really felt connected to the brand and to the business, because in a sense they and rightly so helped to make it happen.
Right.
Which is, I mean, the sort of loyalty and engagement that we had for that restaurant was just like, it was wild. It was really high.
And that you opened in 2012. Is that right?
Yeah, yeah, just at the end of the year.
Yeah,
yeah.
And then you closed it last year in 2017?
At the very beginning of the year, yeah.
Got it.
Yeah.
And that was due to, as I understand it, a lot of the sort of normal pressures on businesses in New York, real estate,
yeah, I mean,
costs of operation.
It's a combination of a lot of things. I mean, the business never really worked well as, I mean, the food was great, the ambiance was great, but there were things that were done incorrectly from the start, which was basically just like the cost of us physically operating there never correlated with the number of chairs that we had in the restaurant. And just these are basic things that, having never had built a restaurant before, I didn't know.
Yeah.
And so there were, and we ultimately always stayed afloat because we were doing a lot of catering business and right, things like that. But the like nail on the coffin was when the building that we were in got sold to a development group that had the plan on leveling it to build a condo. Actually, I drove by there 5 minutes ago. Now, I mean, it's completely gone.
Oh, really? I haven't been down that block in a long time. Yeah.
So that was, I mean, that was it. But it was, in a certain sense, you know, hindsight's 20/20, and I guess in a certain, you know, it was a little bit of a blessing in disguise, because while I loved what we were doing at the barbecue place, it pushed me into another arena, which has ultimately been equally rewarding and rewarding in a different way.
Yeah. So let's talk about that. I mean, so what you're alluding to is Delaney Chicken.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, I feel like it, again, in the model that we talked about at the opening of the show, of this kind of singular food restaurant, it's a fried chicken, right? Yeah. And the focus is really fried chicken sandwiches, but you can also get regular fried chicken as well. Is that correct?
At this point, it's just sandwiches.
Just sandwiches. Yeah. Got it.
It's so a really small menu. We have three different types of sandwiches, bags of chips, and some
that's great.
Drinks and lemonade.
Yeah, I think that's really smart. And so that you currently have a location open, and that's in Vanderbilt Market.
Yeah, right. So it's right across from Grand Central on 45th and Vanderbilt.
Yeah. And you were one of the original tenants in that space, correct?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. What was interesting about the design of that business is that I had learned, I was so battle scarred from trying to run the barbecue business. Because what I think a lot of people never understood or it was not clear is that we never were cooking our food in the restaurant in Bristol.
You had to move it all around,
right? We built a commissary kitchen in Bushwick. And so we were kind of like a commissary business, a logistics company to like shuttle things around and a restaurant.
Right.
And that put a lot of pressure on the infrastructure, on the team. It was a hard thing to pull off. And so when I went into building the chicken place, I was really sensitive to not wanting to make those mistakes again. And so articulated the entire process to be able to operate without, for the first year we did, but eventually to operate without the use of any sort of offsite commissary or production, which is where it is today. So we actually don't even use like back of house facilities or anything.
It's all in that stall.
The whole business is in the 260 square foot stall.
That's amazing.
Prep to receiving to everything. Yeah.
Wow, that's incredible. And the last time I was in that space, you guys had a long line. So I assume you're putting out a lot of product from that tiny amount of space.
Yeah, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of sandwiches per day.
Wow.
And it's very efficient. I mean, having a small menu, having the way the menu is designed with us really using the same core piece of chicken and the same bun and changing things through condiment allows us to be really quick. So in ultimately for us at this location, it's all about lunch.
Right.
And so we have a lot of guests that come through in a short window of time, and we have to be able to see that they're getting fed. And we're usually able to see that people are getting their food in under 30 seconds.
Wow. That's incredibly fast, especially in a high paced place like Midtown. And as you point out, it's lunch.
Yeah.
Right. Exactly. And you know, lunch is a very different animal, than dinner. And very different in that environment where really you're talking about someone standing at a window to get food and then sit in a communal table instead of sitting at a restaurant waiting for a waiter or waitress to come over, pour water, order drinks, then order food. That's a different kind of scene.
Yeah.
We're going to take a short break and hear from one of our sponsors. And when I come back, I want to hear about, you know, what's next. Are you taking on White Manna?
We'll see.
Welcome all you strangers to the Great Divide. Welcome all you strangers to the Great Divide.
Today's program was brought to you by Wisconsin Cheese. What do you think of when you hear Wisconsin cheese? For me, I think cheese curds. Delicious, fresh and squeaky cheese curds. Or deep fried cheese curds. Cheese curds literally any way, anytime, any place. I think about Andy Hatch and Uplands Cheese, the farmstead cheese company behind Pleasant Ridge Reserve. I think of delicious stinky Limburger and its long storied history. I think of Dunbarton Blue, made by master cheesemaker Chris Raleigh. I think of Ross Grand Cru Sirchois, which was named 2016's World Championship Cheese, and Sutari's Black Pepper Bellavitano, the 2017 U.S. Championship Cheese. Wisconsin produces the world's best cheese, with lush grasslands and a glacial water supply that produce the very best milk. Fourth generation cheesemakers combine old world tradition with new ideas and the highest standards to make innovative cheeses that win more awards than any other state or country.
And if I go and go alone, will you still rule my heart's stone?
Welcome back to Feast Your Ears. I'm Harry Rosenblum, and today I have in the studio with me Dan Delaney from Delaney Chicken. Before the break, we were talking about Dan and my own love of places that really focus on one type of food or make one kind of thing and do it really well and have been doing it for a long time. I feel like there's also an aspect of the thing I love about those places, and you brought it up, Dan, as being patina. Mm-hmm. But I feel like, you know, it's also its history, right? Yeah. I mean, if you go to a place and you understand that the person behind the counter grew up there and was doing it and learned it from, you know, their father or mother or aunt or uncle or something like that, that there, you know, it's the history of that, I think, that's really, you know, you can create a great place, and you did, right, that made barbecue and it had a certain aesthetic, but it didn't necessarily have that history.
Right. And I think that that's some, I mean, one, it's a privilege, right? You feel that being able to go into these places where they are generational. And like I was driving back from, I was in Wyoming recently, and I drove there and drove back. And as I drove back, I stopped at this place called Phillips. It looks like the White Manna. And, you know, you're sitting next to these guys, these families that have been going there for years. So there's also a privilege that you through the vehicle of these like institutional restaurants, you also really get to connect with locals. But for me, going into like, I think it runs a risk when you're doing something like bringing barbecue up to New York or any of these foods, you start to run this risk of like becoming a parody. And that's fine. A lot of places do that and they just embrace the idea that they are ultimately a parody, and that's what they do. But it is an interesting internal question, which is, I know that I'm not going to open up an institutional restaurant. That's not going to happen in my lifetime because I know that that's not my MO. And so, but I still intend to be opening and operating things in the hospitality space. So I have to, I guess, at a certain point, embrace the fact that that's never going to be what I do. I can cherish it and love it, but I think that you have to be sensitive about how much you lean on the idea of nostalgia, because you then start to become a parody of these other places. And then there's something disingenuous about that. And I think that customers realize that.
Sure. Yep. So Delaney Chicken, you're looking to expand to your home state.
We are looking to expand in general, and we're looking at a lot of different things. The space that we're hoping to get open soon is one in North Jersey in the town of Paramus, and it'll be inside of a mall called the Garden State Plaza.
Got it. And like everything else in Paramus, does that mean it would have to be closed on Saturdays?
Well, it's Sundays.
Or Sundays.
And the blue law in New Jersey is that retail has to be closed on Sundays. So any food service operator could be open on a Sunday.
But it's just Paramus, right? It's not the whole state.
It's all of Bergen County.
All of Bergen County. Okay. Yeah. Because what I remember being a kid is that my head family, aunts, uncles, cousins, stuff in Jersey. And I remember we would drive out there and like the parking lots on Sunday would be empty when you drive through Paramus. Yeah. And it was so weird to me because everywhere else in the world, Sunday is a huge shopping day.
Yeah. So we could be open on Sunday. We'll test that and see how that goes.
Yeah. Right. Because there won't be anybody at the mall buying stuff.
Yeah.
Necessarily.
Yeah. But the mall has a really large movie theater in it. It has a lot of other amenities that are open on Sundays. There are restaurants there that are open on Sundays and things like that. Yeah.
And is that a much bigger space than what you have in Manhattan?
Yeah. So what we have in Manhattan is essentially part of a food hall. Yeah. And this is a full inline restaurant where we have, I don't know, something 45 seats inside of it. So it looks much different. It feels like a traditional restaurant that you would go in, get food, and sit yourself within our four walls.
Got it.
Yeah.
And then is your hope from there, where are you headed?
So
like in 5 years, where do you want Delaney Chicken to be?
You know, I learned this statistic, and I think I shared this with you the other day, which is that like Domino's Pizza, 90% of the people that own a Domino's franchise started as a delivery driver. And so and that's amazing. That means that they've built the infrastructure to take somebody that has not a tremendous set of skills, or they're just starting out in this industry and help to incubate them and to grow them to be able to own a business and to also provide the resources to make that happen.
Domino's also, as I understand it, has grown like enormously in the past 10 years.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's my, I really like that goal. You know, when you're figuring out like how, you know, you want to expand something, there's a lot of ways to do this. A lot of people go through sort of the route of getting private equity kind of financing and open up a lot of corporate stores to eventually be acquired. My love for like legacy brands and legacy restaurants, I think is ultimately going to prevent me from wanting to do that. Yeah. And so the idea of trying to expand through a franchising system is something that's really attractive to me. I've had so many, the opportunity of working with so many amazing people that like through, because of whatever circumstance, didn't have all the opportunity that I had in life. And if I could, I mean, really great people working in, I mean, it's like, just like the, some of the most hardworking people work in hospitality. And so if there's a way to leverage this and to be able to build opportunity for people to become small business owners, I think that's really great.
Yeah.
So I like that. That's the path that I hope to follow with this.
Cool. And, you know, do you have other types of restaurants that you have sort of like workshopped in your mind, like that you've thought about opening?
Yeah. I mean, well, number one is I do hope to revisit barbecue.
Yeah.
I think that having while it's sort of being put on ice at this point, there's a lot of great techniques and recipes that we figured out over these 5 years. And I think that I think that when we were open and we were producing our barbecue at really our peak, it was some of the best in the country. So I do think that that's something that I would like to revisit at some point in the future. I'm interested in burgers. It's something that I've been attracted to for a while, and I wouldn't be surprised if at some point, you know, there's that. But I don't have 500 chicken places open. So until that happens, right, I think that I need to be focused on it.
Sure. You mentioned, I had asked, if you could have one food for the rest of your life, what would it be? And you said a Wisconsin butter burger. I don't know what that is. What is a Wisconsin butter burger?
It was a really hard question, but because
I know, and we're not going to hold you to it.
Yeah, there's obviously so many things, but yeah. I love the Wisconsin butter burger. It's a really cool thing. So there, it's a griddled burger.
Like White Manna.
Like White Manna, yeah. Burger.
Unlike Burger King, flame broiled.
And they also toast the bun using sort of more of a dry toasting method as opposed to like a contact toasting method.
Yep.
And then they put these sort of like sauteed onions on top of the cheese on the burger, then sauteed onions. And then as they're assembling the burger, they take like a knob of tempered room temperature butter that's salted, and they just smear it over the top of the bun, and you know, then put that crown on the top of the burger right before it comes to the table. So the steam from the onions and the steam from the residual heat of the meat sort of permeate up and liquefy the butter, and it melts down into itself.
I mean, having just had the ad in the middle of the show or the beginning of the show for Wisconsin and all the cheese, right? Okay, so then the cheese, the dairy, the butter. Wisconsin's also the first place I ever had frozen custard, which was essentially like frozen ice cream made from like double cream butter.
Yeah, yeah.
So you could have that butter burger, and then you could have a frozen custard, and then you could just die. Right. I mean, your heart would just seize up, I think.
It would. In general, I think that, like, as I try and invent, like, I love pizza. I really like these,
Sure. Classic stuff that's not fussy.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Speaking of burgers, have you been to Louis Lunch in New Haven?
Of course. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's an interesting burger. I mean, I don't know that I love it as an institution. I don't know that it's my
has
favorite
that thing about being old and having done it the exact same way.
So for those that don't know, it's credited as the oldest burger in the country.
Yep.
And they cook through a pretty unusual technique, which are these sort of vertical grills where they take the meat and they kind of close it into this basket, similar to like how you would cook toast on a campfire, and slide that into a vertical toaster, which broils it.
Yeah.
And it's served
gas broilers. Yeah,
yeah. Yeah. And it's served on white bread that's also toasted with a slice of tomato. I think that's it.
I think you can get cheese.
Oh, you
can get cheese instead of tomato.
But there's no other ketchup. There's no other condiment. And and this is another great example of the patina. Like, it's kind of built out of all these sort of really hefty woods, the whole place, that people have like etched their name in. Yep. And so it's like, you know, Sarah loves John 1971. Or, and that's great. Like, it's like a time machine to be able to step into these places.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
You mentioned that your one of your favorite books is Ham on Rye.
Yes.
I was trying to remember. I was looking for my copy, actually, this morning when I was preparing the show. I couldn't find it. I mean, what is it about that or about Bukowski that you love?
I think that I'm, in general, maybe this is growing up on the East Coast, there's like a slight attraction to like misery. You know, there's like something attractive about getting things wrong more so than just getting everything right. Yeah. And I think that when I go into restaurants and other environments, I think about them very theatrically. I think about, you know, the life of the person that's sitting at the counter drinking the cup of coffee and such. And so I think that what's enjoyable about that book is just the amount of vivid detail that is shared in his pretty rough childhood. It's visceral. There's a level of like very humorous suffering, which is something that is like big in New York, right? We like love to laugh at like our own misfortune a bit, and it's absurd that we're all here. I think that he was also just like, I think I'm also just attracted to things like the diner and these other institutions, and whether or not, I mean, it's not a huge part of the book, but I, you know, also like imagine the character outside, and I imagine that he would sit at the same restaurants that I would want to sit at.
Sure.
Yeah.
Sure. Well, we're just about out of time. Anything else that you want to bring up? Any events going on related to Delaney Chicken?
No, I mean,
you guys don't do any like festivals or anything, do you?
No, and it was actually interesting. We also did no press when we opened, which was a very different thing. Like when we opened the place, we basically declined all press interviews, which was interesting because it was a very active thought. In a sense, it allowed me to sort of have our developmental period the way that we did with Brisket Lab, which was before the, you know, the droves of people come. It's a way for us to like get the product right. And it wasn't for a while. We had a lot of development to do to make it work. So, but no events at this point. It's just like, you know, grinding away, getting this thing going, building more and more systems. But, I guess the only thing that one of the things I'm looking forward to is that I think that in probably the next month or so, I'm going to start to make video content again, which I haven't done for years.
Yeah, I was going to touch on that, but we're kind of out of time. You used to produce an online show.
Yeah, about street food. But I've grown to love the entrepreneurial side of hospitality so much that I'm looking to start to make video content again, but about that, about what it is to try and grow a business, because I think it's very interesting. It's kind of like pulling the curtain back on Oz, and something that I think most people are fascinated by, but really don't have much access to.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, thank you so much for joining me. You can follow along as Dan maybe starts a new online video show or whatever it's going to be, at Daniel Delaney is his social media handle. And you can check out danieldelaney.com. And, I hope that everybody will make it over there and either to Manhattan or very soon to Paramus and eat some fried chicken sandwich. That's actually, as we're sitting here talking, I'm getting hungrier and hungrier. And I'm like, maybe we should have pizza, or maybe we should go and maybe I should drive and go get White Manna, although it's a little bit far from Brooklyn. But thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you.
Thanks, everybody, for listening to Feast Your Ears today. Big thank you to David Tadashore, who engineers this show. You can find Feast Your Ears, as well as lots of other great shows, at heritageradionetwork.org and on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. Please take a moment to like the show on iTunes or Stitcher, and please reach out if you have any questions. You can reach me via email, harry@thebrooklynkitchen.com, and you can follow me on social media, @thefoodballer. Talk to you next week.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at Heritage_Radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.